What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I'm so excited to be here with you. We have a great show for you, a stellar lineup. We're going to be hearing during the second half of the show from Craig McIver, who is a longtime international human rights lawyer who served as director of the New York office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. And he has resigned after publicly accusing the UN of failing to address what he calls a textbook case of genocide unfolding in Gaza. So we're going to be talking to Craig about what it was that made him resign. But before that, we are going to be talking to an all-Jewish panel, a Jewish Voice for Peace panel. Before I introduce those esteemed guests who we're about to bring on, please do like the stream. It's a really easy way to support the show and bring people to the show. The more likes it gets, the better it does in the algorithm. Please subscribe if you haven't already subscribed. And to do that, you just hit subscribe and then you press the bell. That way you never miss any of these streams. And also we're going to be starting to do some extra streams. So not just Tuesdays at 7 p.m., which is, of course, when we stream every week. So you're definitely going to want to be notified of that. If you can, please become Patreon supporters. That helps this show happen. We couldn't do the show without you at Patreon. And that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. For $1 a month, you make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you make the show happen and you get all sorts of great Patreon-only exclusive content. So again, patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. And we are so excited to bring this great panel together. We're going to be talking to Roslyn Pachesky, a political scientist and member of Jewish Voice for Peace, who was arrested protesting outside of Chuck Schumer's house last month. Jay Saper is an artist, translator, educator, organizer, and also member of Jewish Voice for Peace. And Brant Rosen is a Reconstructionist rabbi of Tzedek, Chicago, an anti-Zionist synagogue he co-founded in August 2015. And he's also co-chair of the Jewish Voice for Peace Rabbinical Council. So welcome, Roz, Jay, and Rabbi Brant. How are you?
Happy to be here. Thank you, Katie.
Of course. Thank you all for all that you've been doing. You've been so active. We have some great footage. In fact, just yesterday, I was with some of you at the Statue of Liberty, where you were saying, not in our name, never again is now, and ceasefire now. Brad, can you share with people the Democracy Now! Coverage of that event? It was pretty stunning. I'm trying to build on the suspense. We could also start, if it's better, Brad, with some of their other actions. We could start with their action at Grand Central. Norman Finkelstein himself, none other than Norm Finkelstein, attended the Grand Central action and also mentioned that it was breathtaking. So let's take a look at the Grand Central Station action. Does one of you want to set up what happened? Or it kind of speaks for itself, I guess.
At Grand Central?
Yeah.
Jay, do you want to tell how that was organized?
Yeah, so thousands of Jewish New Yorkers shut down the world's biggest train station during rush hour traffic to call for a ceasefire. It was the largest act of civil disobedience New York City has seen in 20 years since the beginning of the Iraq War.
Yeah. So let's take a look.
New York's famous Grand Central Station. And you can see banners reading, Palestinians should be free.
Thousands of members of Jewish Voice for Peace and their allies shut down the main terminal of Grand Central Station during rush hour. 400 people were arrested in what's believed to be the largest sit-in protest New York has seen in over two decades.
This is the Jewish Voice for Peace to support the protests. Ceasefire. The turnout is massive. Thousands of New Yorkers united in a call for peace.
At one point, there were so many protesters, the terminal was closed.
The group, made up mostly of Jewish New Yorkers, is calling for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Wearing t-shirts that read, not in our name.
Right now, you are hearing thousands of Jewish New Yorkers who are raising our voices so clear that our safety can never come at the expense of another community's safety.
Of Jewish activists, people from all backgrounds work here.
I'm here because the U.S. government is funding the bombardment, the indiscriminate bombing of 2.2 million Palestinians in Gaza who have no access to fuel, have no access to medical supplies. Their hospitals are being bombed, their schools are being bombed. There is nowhere to go.
What's happening to Palestinians has been happening for decades, and it must end now.
Sources say NYPD arrested close to 300 people, possibly more.
It's been a pretty extraordinary night inside Grand Central Terminal. Take a look right behind me here. Members of that Jewish activist group standing on a ledge next to the departure sign. You've got the NYPD trying to get them down. This was sort of reminiscent of a protest back in 1991 when members of ACT UP went on that ledge and protested. So what you're watching right now are members of the Jewish Voice for Peace being taken into custody. They are demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. And for the most part, it's been pretty peaceful here.
My Jewish tradition teaches me that life is precious. And that is why so many of us are doing all that we can to try to save lives in Gaza. To call for an immediate ceasefire so that Gaza can live.
So there's more to come, and we were going to be talking about some of the more to come that has happened since that video. But I guess I just wanted to start off by asking, what is Jewish Voice for Peace? Tell us about the history of it and when it was founded and what motivated each of you to join.
Rabbi Brandt, tell us about the history. You've probably been in it longer than any of us.
You're muted. What a metaphor for being silenced over your views.
I will not be silenced. So Jewish Voice for Peace was founded in the mid-90s. It was originally a local San Francisco organization, and then it became a national organization when it merged together with other Jewish peace and justice organizations throughout the country. And it's grown steadily since that time. And it really is a Palestine solidarity organization, I think, at its heart. It is a group of Jews guided and inspired by Jewish tradition and Jewish historical experience and Jewish culture to stand with the oppressed and call out the oppressor. And as you saw from that very powerful video, particularly when this is being done in our name by the State of Israel, it is the largest Jewish anti-Zionist organization in the world. It's also one of the largest Palestine solidarity organizations in the world. And it, you know, I think, tragically, I would say, it tends to grow at times like this. I became very involved with it in 2008 during another onslaught on Gaza. It was known as Operation Cast Lead. And I was a congregational, I I am still a congregational rabbi, but I was in my former congregation, I was moving closer and closer toward taking a Palestine solidarity approach. And 2008, 2009 was really the final straw for me. And I broke with my lifelong liberal Zionism, so-called, and said that I can't do this anymore. You know, I can't justify this. I can't rationalize this. And I became involved with Jewish Voice for Peace, among other things. And then a few years later, in 2014 or 15, no, it was 2012, I'm sorry, co-founded the Rabbinical Council of Jewish Voice for Peace with Rabbi Alyssa Wise, and have been calling JVP my institutional and spiritual Jewish home ever since.
I was the next generation, I guess. I would say I've been a Palestine solidarity person in my heart and in my politics for most of my life. But I didn't really know about Jewish Voice for Peace. I went into Jewish Voice for Peace in 2013. Somebody brought me in. It was around BDS. It was around challenging our pension system, TIAA CREF. And I went and confronted the guy who was the president of it.
And BDS, for people who don't know, that's Boycott, Divest, Sanction.
Yes. We were trying to get the TIAA CREF to divest from, you know, Zionist and military corporations that were funding Israel. But I really came in with lots of other people, as Rabbi Brand said, at times of crisis. That's when we gain many, many new members. Like right now, we're absolutely overwhelmed with our new members. In 2013, 2014, there was another horrible siege on Gaza. It was the most horrible until now. And I, with many, many other people, joined Jewish Voice for Peace. And I, like Rabbi Brandt, I quickly realized this is my political home. This is what I've been looking for my whole life, trying to be a Palestine solidarity person, not really figuring out where is the place for this? Where's my community? And here it is. And it's an extraordinary experience, not just to be, you know, validated in your politics and in your passion to support Palestinians. Mine is rooted in close friends, my mentor in college, my students, many Palestinians who have deeply affected my life and been my dear friends. But it's also the experience of being in solidarity with many others and doing the actions that you're showing here together. It's, our hearts are broken and we're also steadfast. We are determined. We are going to stop this war and get a ceasefire. We're going to do it.
And what about you, Jay?
I grew up hearing stories from my Aunt Jerry, who grew up in Jackson, Mississippi during Jim Crow. Her synagogue was bombed when she was a child, and her rabbi's home was bombed because of her community's work to support the Black freedom struggle. I learned from her that my Jewish tradition means that we take action for justice. And so I've been supporting justice for Palestinians organizing in the Jewish community for over a decade. When I was an undergraduate student at Middlebury College, I started a Students for Justice for Palestine chapter there. I faced an expulsionary hearing in college for my activism around divestment. And I feel so grateful and honored to get to reunite with one of my co-defendants in that trial just the other week in the Washington, D.C. jail. After Rabbi Brant Rosen delivered such passionate remarks on the Washington National Mall to the largest gathering of Jews in history in solidarity with Palestinians, we staged a massive sit-in at Congress, one of the largest sit-ins Congress has ever seen. Over 300 of us got arrested, and where I reunited with one of my friends who over a decade ago, we began organizing together.
What is it about your Jewish identity for each of you? Because I think you probably have, in some ways, it's, we share things in common, in some ways it's different. What is it about being Jewish that makes what you're doing part of your identity?
Maybe I'll take a first try at that. I think I would answer that two ways. I think I would answer it, you know, similar to what Jay was saying about his own family experience. I was always raised to believe that to be Jewish meant to stand for justice. I come from a family in which those two things were just synonymous and really kind of taken for granted, that that's really what it meant to be Jewish. That my parents were, particularly my mother, were powerful role models in that regard. You know, I think there was a great deal of cognitive dissonance when it came to Israel and Zionism, because we also, my family identified deeply with Israel. We have family there. We, you know, I have a strong connection to Israel through my family. And so that was something I always struggled with and had a hard time squaring. And, you know, eventually, as I said, broke with. And my folks, to their credit, you know, they understood, they respected my decision. They watched my evolution. And I think in some ways kind of were partners in that as well in some ways. You know, the other thing I would say from a spiritual point of view is that, you know, and this is something that Jay said as well, that, you know, in that video, that all life is precious, that to me has always been my understanding of the central teaching of Torah, that all human beings were made in the divine image. We learn that in the book of Genesis. There's a famous Talmudic debate about this, about what is the most foundational teaching from Torah. And Rabbi Ben Azai differs with another rabbi who says it's love your neighbor as yourself. And he said, no, it's that all human beings are made in the divine image, that treat your neighbor as yourself has to do with your immediate community. But when you talk about all human beings are basically children of God, that means everyone. That means Jewish, not Jewish, Israelites, Moabites, you know, all the ites. and that is something that I cherish deeply, and particularly it serves me well at times like this. You know, at the rally and the action that Jay was talking about, or just watching that video from Grand Central, to me, the core of that statement was so deeply Jewish, in as much as that it's a universal statement that, you know, we are all connected through our basic and common humanity.
Rabbi, did you have an aha moment with Zionism when you really realized you couldn't stay silent anymore?
Yeah. So it was a gradual evolution, a process of just questioning and struggling. But my breaking point, as I said, was 2008. And I had signed a letter, which was a big deal for me, condemning the blockade when it started in 2007. And that was, for me, at that time, sticking out my neck, because I was learning more and more from friends about what was going on in Gaza. And then when Operation Cast Lead broke out, I remember vividly, I was sitting in front of my computer reading the news reports, and the initial reports were just horrible. I mean, what we're seeing now just is so much farther beyond what we could ever imagine. But I was reading about back then, it was an assault on Gaza City, which is now currently being leveled as we speak. But the initial attack killed hundreds of people at a police cadet graduation ceremony, and it also killed numerous hundreds of civilians and children. And I just remember reading this news and just thinking, I just can't do this anymore. You know, I had been writing a blog mostly to keep in touch with my congregants, but also increasingly just sharing my thoughts about the world. And I wrote a blog post saying, this is a war crime, and I'm not going to apologize for this anymore, and I'm tired of it. And that was really my breaking point, and I've been kind of going down that road ever since.
Wow. And Roz, what about you? Did you start out anti-Zionist early on, or?
No, I grew up in a very liberal Zionist family in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My family believed very much in the state of Israel. My father went there. My grandmother went there. I went there when I was 16 years old, and it happened to be the beginning of the civil rights movement. So like Jay, for me, there's a connection between anti-racism and supporting Palestine. They're integrally woven. When I went to Israel, I was 16, and I witnessed racism on a kibbutz. I was talking to a black man. He happened to be an African Jew. They wouldn't even let us go near Palestinians, right? And I was just having a conversation. And this white woman with a very distinct Brooklyn accent came up to me. She said, don't talk to him. And I said, well, why not? She said, he's African. I thought, what? I was becoming a civil rights activist. I was becoming an anti-racist. And I thought, this is not what we learned. And I thought justice was universal. And I thought justice was related to anti-racism. And I thought justice, as our dear friend Esther Farmer always said, is not just for us. So I was so shocked and upset. And I came home and I was giving talks around town. In high school, I was like this little public speaker. And the rabbi, a local rabbi, repudiated me in front of elders in the community and told them, wrote to them and said, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's just a young girl. And it's not like that. I was just there. She's wrong. And there, so you can't say for me, anti-racism, supporting Palestine, and feminism are completely interlinked. That was the beginning of all of those for me. And then they just grew with many circumstances and historical contexts as the years went by. That was my aha moment.
And Roz is a very, I didn't have time to read Roz's full biography, but she is not only distinguished professor emerita of political science at Hunter College and the Graduate Center, but she's a widely published feminist scholar, recipient of a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, and her book, Abortion and Women's Choice, the State, Sexuality, and Reproductive Freedom, was cited by the United States Supreme Court in its landmark decision, Planned Parenthood v. Casey. So how is this a feminist issue for you?
Entirely. I mean, I could go on. I don't want to go on too long. First of all, just think about the legendary feminist anti-war movements. Just think about Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Just think about Code Pink. Just think about all the women in Black groups. Just think about feminists everywhere who have said masculinist militarism is destroying the world. We cannot support that. We cannot support war. It never solves problems. Think about, and I'm going to say this right here. I haven't said this before. But there is a hostage named Vivian Silver. You've probably read about her. I heard about her. Someone sent me a message about her, and there was a whole article in the Washington Post. Vivian Silver is one of the hostages kidnapped by Hamas, 74 years old, a lifelong feminist peace activist who marched with Women Wage Peace in Israel, who has consistently opposed Israel's policies, which takes a lot of guts in Israel. There's a lot of censuring and ostracizing of people. She even ferried Gazan children to Israeli hospitals. She's in custody still with 241 other hostages. And I am not going to applaud that. I am not going to celebrate that, what Hamas did. Those were war crimes. But there is no equivalence between that and the genocide that Israel is committing. And I think of genocide actually as a prevention of the reproduction of an entire people. That's what it is. I mean, if you look historically always at the occupation, what it did, closing checkpoints, women giving birth at checkpoints, hospitals under, and especially in Gaza. Before this, how do you have a safe childbirth? How do you take care of your children and family without sanitation, without water, without electricity? You can't do it. Or when your home is being demolished around you, how do you take care of families? And that's what Palestinian women do. It is a fairly patriarchal culture. Women are taking care of children and the families. They do it heroically. And I have to say, I don't look to men for solutions. I don't. Not the men who are in power. I'm looking to our movement. And one more thing. This is in Grand Central, and then yesterday at the Statue of Liberty. I had never heard this before, but a song, "Where You Go, Palestine, I Will Go. You are my people, you are mine." This comes from the Book of Ruth. That was my favorite part of the Old Testament. As a child, Ruth saying to Naomi, Naomi says to Ruth, I mean, their men were all killed in war, right? Naomi's husband is dead. Her sons are dead. Her two daughters-in-law are there. And she says to them, you go and be with your people in your village, wherever you came from. And Ruth refuses. And she says, whither thou goest, I will go. Whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people are my people. Thy God is my God. And that's in a song now that we're singing to Palestine. That's incredible. That means there's a feminist anthem that's becoming part of our movement. And I am so incredibly overwhelmed and heartened by that. And I think that speaks to the kind of movement we're building.
Thanks. And Jay, what about you?
I grew up in a small Jewish community in the Midwest where the most fervent Zionists were Christian Zionists. And there are more Christian Zionists in the world than there are even Jews. My parents raised me to speak up, to question abuses of power. And so they've been so proud of me to take action that I believe is important, to join communities that are taking action together for justice. And this evening, while we're talking right now, my mom is supporting her friend by attending a memorial service with her. My mom's friend's close friend was killed in Gaza, and 15 members of his family were killed as well. And so that is through our community here that we transform grief into action. And that's why we're doing everything we can to bring about a ceasefire.
And were you raised by anti-Zionist parents or non-Zionist parents, or did you have an evolution there?
I grew up without a connection to the state of Israel. Again, the most fervent Zionists in my community were Christian, and my parents raised me to speak up when I saw something that was wrong. And so that certainly supported me and cultivated me in articulating and coming to practice my anti-Zionist politics in community with Jewish Voice for Peace.
And also, am I correct, Jay, that you speak Yiddish?
He translates the Yiddish. You're an Yiddish expert.
Yeah, so talk about that.
Yeah, so every night that I've spent in jail these past couple of weeks, I've actually spent time speaking Yiddish inside with fellow activists who are Yiddishists, who are so passionate about our language, one of many Jewish languages from around the world. The majority of the speakers were massacred by the Nazis during the Holocaust. Our love of Yiddish comes from a deep commitment to supporting all vulnerable cultures. It comes from a commitment to challenging fascism, to challenging the erasure of culture. It also comes from a deep commitment to internationalism. Yiddish is a language of diaspora. We as a Jewish people have existed between and among people all around the world. We have flourished without militaries in relationship to and learning from and shaping many other cultures, many other languages. I've started to help Roz on a research project on her family.
He's brilliant.
And where they come from, the shtetl that her family comes from, called Dizna. And what we have of that town today is a Yitzchak book, a book written by survivors in Yiddish. And so I've been supporting Roz and learning more about her family's history in that town, which I've been able to access through translating the Yiddish for her. And I see that as compelling me to take action to support Palestine right now, because what we are doing is trying to make sure that the memorial books that will be written about this moment do not get thicker by a single page, that there is a living, breathing Palestinian culture in Gaza left, not just an archival remnant of it. And so my passion for Yiddish and my speaking of Yiddish and cultivating new Yiddish art while also translating Yiddish poetry from the ghettos and from the forests where partisans fought against the Nazi, that same love of Yiddish is what compels me to speak out today against what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in Gaza.
And Yiddish, of course, in many ways is a language and a culture that the founders of Israel were quite ashamed of.
They suppressed it. They made Hebrew the official national language as part of the ethno-nationalist politics.
Yeah, there's, of course, as you were saying, Jay, there's an internationalist, and diasporic culture that is the opposite of Israel in many ways, which is based around a physical nation, which is, I'm glad this is fascinating because this is a type of, because of Israel, people don't understand that there's all this Jewish heritage and culture and tradition and ethos that's really antithetical to Israel because Israel claims to speak for all Jews.
It's also important to keep in mind that Judaism itself came out of the diaspora. Judaism itself was a response to living in diaspora. And for thousands of years, Jewish spiritual and cultural creativity flourished in the soil of the diaspora. And Israel, Zionism really arose as a movement relatively recently in Jewish history, really in the late 19th century. They espoused this concept in Hebrew called Shlilat HaGalut, negating the diaspora. They saw the diaspora as something to be ashamed of. And they lifted up this kind of nation-statist form of Judaism, which was just radically counter to everything it ever meant to be Jewish. And so the fact that for so many people now Judaism equals Zionism, it really flies in the face of history. And I think people need to understand what Judaism is and where it came from.
Yeah, can you talk about that? That the fact that, as you just said, people conflate the two things. And the irony is that the people who conflate being Jewish with being a Zionist are kind of rabid anti-Semites who use those terms interchangeably. And then places like Israel, Israeli government, and AIPAC and the Anti-Defamation League. So can you guys talk about that?
Roz, do you want to?
Well, we can all talk about it. I mean, the conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism is such a category mistake. It's nonsensical. Criticizing a government's policies is not the same thing as espousing that whole nation state. Israel is not my homeland. I'm a citizen of the United States. Ethno-nationalism is vicious wherever it is. It's really a toxic creation, I'm sorry, of modernity. And I think we have to stand against it wherever, because it always means victimizing and marginalizing and ostracizing, if not killing, whole groups of people. So when Jews who went to Palestine and became Zionists embraced that kind of thinking, it was a tragedy. It was a tragedy for Jews in history. And we didn't know, we thought, well, I mean, all the mystification that says you have to embrace the state of Israel in order to be safe as a Jew, it's the opposite. It makes us less safe.
Well, October 7th put an end to that, I think, once and for all.
I wish it put an end. I don't think it did.
I don't think most people think that, yeah.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, they're saying this is the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, and it occurred in Israel, which was ostensibly created to safeguard Jewish lives. So
logically, you're right.
Logically, you're right. But sadly, I think for lots of people, the solution is to kill off the people of Gaza.
Right. And that shows the work we have, the nature of the work we have to do, the hard work we have to do.
And we have to be clear on what anti-Semitism is, when we also challenge what it isn't, when we also speak up against everyone who supports justice for Palestine and is falsely smeared as anti-Semitic. A 19-year-old Nazi was indicted this June for planning to carry out a mass shooting at my congregation, my synagogue, where I grew up in East Lansing, Michigan, Congregation Cherry Zedek, where I had my bi mitzvah, where my grandparents had their funerals, where my parents still attend services. The gunman planning this massacre was planning to carry it out on the fifth anniversary of the Christchurch massacre at the mosques in New Zealand. He had also written about his admiration for the shooter who carried out a shooting against Black people in a grocery store in Buffalo. This makes so clear that anti-Semitism is absolutely a threat to our community, and how we can confront it is by taking action against Islamophobia, speaking up against anti-Black racism, recognizing that we have to confront white supremacy together, that our safety and our freedom and our liberation is intertwined. So we refuse narratives that try to pit our communities against one another and know that Palestinians deserve to live in freedom and with dignity, and supporting justice for Palestinians brings us closer to a world where we all get to live with justice, where we all get to feel safe.
And Jay's story underlines how the same people who hate Jews hate Black people, the same people who hate Muslims hate Jews. I mean, that hatred, you know, it is basically about white supremacy, and we have to join together.
There's this insidious Jewish attitude toward anti-Semitism, which is that it's somehow exceptional, that it's somehow a unique form of hatred, different from all others in the world, and that to be a Jew just means to be inherently unsafe, more than anybody else, to be the, you know, the archetypal victim targeted person in the world. And I think after October 7th, we're seeing that meme, you know, that trope being spread through the Jewish community in really, really destructive ways, when what we need to be doing right now more than ever, along with what Jay and Roz are saying, is we need to be finding safety through solidarity, because, you know, hatred against a particular group of people is the same. You know, we're seeing a rise in intolerances all over the world for the last 10 plus years. If ever there was a time for solidarity, it's right now. But the circling of the wagons in the Jewish community, I just find to be so toxic and insidious.
And that trope has been cultivated deliberately by Zionists and Zionist organizations to garner support, to use the politics of fear and make people feel that they have no choice. So we have to show them an alternative, a different way of being, a different approach to justice.
Right. And it is, I mean, what do you guys say to all these people who say, without Israel, Jews would be killed? Without Israel, Israel's the only reason we haven't had another Holocaust. What's your response to those things? Because I keep encountering that.
So why haven't you moved to Israel? You're standing right here on Broadway in your fur coat.
I would say it's the opposite. I think Israel makes Jews unsafe all over the world. You know, I think, look, if we all agree that it's anti-Semitic to associate Jews with all Jews everywhere with the actions of the state of Israel, the problem is that Israel purports to be the state for all Jews everywhere. So everything Israel does impacts on all of us. And when Israel acts oppressively, that reflects on Jews throughout the diaspora and makes us patently unsafe. And Zionism in Israel does no favors for Jews and is certainly not a recipe for Jewish safety and security, and it never has been.
Someone in the comments, I just want to debunk this, but you, Rabbi, would be better served. Someone said, Israel and Judaism makes you unsafe. Israel makes you unsafe. I would say Judaism doesn't.
No. I mean, I think we just addressed the issue that Israel and Judaism are not the same thing.
Right.
To my mind, Judaism is a spiritual system for trying to find, you know, injustice throughout the world and healing it and addressing these injustices wherever we happen to live. You know, Zionism is a political movement that arose, you know, very, very recently, that, as Roz was saying, is a form of Jewish ethno-nationalism that doesn't make anybody safe.
But I will say our actions in Grand Central, in the rotunda of the office building, in the Statue of Liberty, all of these actions have aroused tremendous support and from lots of people who are both Jewish and not Jewish. Lots of Muslims, lots of South Asians. I'm sure Jay and Rabbi Brandt have also gotten so many thank yous and comments from people saying, oh, we didn't know that this way of thinking existed, and this is so encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I'll have older, you know, like conservatives or PEP, the term PEP, progressive except on Palestine. They'll say to me, you're making Jews less safe by criticizing Israel. I'm like, no, we're running interference for Israel. Israel's making us unsafe by claiming to act in our names. It's not only the right thing to do to say that Israel isn't acting in our names, but it happens to be, I think, like a safety issue as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I never experienced, I was walking down the street one day in my, I mean, I have to say, I felt very insulated from anti-Semitism. But I one day was walking, little old lady walking down the street in my neighborhood, and a guy, a tall white guy, said, dirty Jew to me. I mean, nobody ever said that to me in my entire, in New York City, in my entire 81 years, nobody had ever said that to me. And I was so shocked I couldn't say anything. You know, where is that coming from? So it's real. I mean, it's very real. But Israel does nothing to address anti-Semitism. They just stir it up.
Yeah. And I wanted to show, let's see, we have some photos and videos of the great action that you guys did at the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, good.
So there's you, there's Roz, black shirt, not in our name. And this was amazing. So you can see all these people at the foot of the Statue of Liberty. Says never again for anyone. Ceasefire now. The whole world is watching. And there's Roz getting arrested at another protest. You guys have been busy. You got arrested in October outside of Chuck Schumer's house. So what made you guys choose to do a protest there?
Do you want to say, Jay?
We've been organizing every waking second since October 7th. We held a march to his home, Senator Schumer's home, that very night. As the majority leader of the Senate, he presides over a body that sends $3.8 billion in military funding to Israel each and every year. Now, the Congress is even looking to expand that to over $14 billion to Israel, which to its military specifically, funding those bombs that are being used right now to rain down upon the people of Gaza. And so that is why we showed up at his doorstep. That is why Roz was blockading the busiest thoroughfare in all of Brooklyn, Grand Army Plaza, right outside of his home, getting arrested to say business as usual cannot go on. This is a crisis. You must take action now for a ceasefire immediately, and an end to U.S. military funding to Israel so we can suppress the root causes of this violence, which is oppression of the Palestinian people who've lived under 75 years of occupation and apartheid. And we have a role in challenging our own government's ongoing complicity and moral cover in those crimes.
Do you think the Western media is complicit in suggesting that Judaism and Jewishness and Zionism are the same?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the mainstream media, when they go for comments about what's going on in the world, they go to Jewish community organizations like Jewish Federations, like the Anti-Defamation League, like, you know, Jewish establishment organizations that are thoroughly Zionist, because they assume they speak for all Jews. And so that creates, you know, the impression among the readers that we are somehow a monolithic community and that we line up behind Zionism in the state of Israel, which is just absolutely not true. I think one of the wonderful things about these JVP actions is that they are getting great press, and JVP's image is being lifted up, I think, in an unprecedented kind of way. And it's just wonderful. It's so liberating to see Jewish spokespeople like those of us in JVP speaking for a large and increasing quarter of the Jewish community that is anti-Zionist, that doesn't support what Israel's doing, and that stand with Palestinians.
And I think there is a shift in the narrative. It's beginning, even in the mainstream media. I mean, I was quoted in the New York Times one sentence after our Grand Central action. And then the march in Washington on Saturday, it was Palestinian-led, hundreds of thousands of people. That was important because it was the first time, it was the largest representation of Palestinians in the public eye in Washington, D.C., saying not only ceasefire now, not only end the occupation, which really goes for 75 years, not since 1967, but since 1948, saying, we're not going to vote for you. We're done. And lots of young people are feeling that way too. So the political pressure is on. Lots of young people in the State Department have signed a letter. Young, you know, staffers in Congress are starting to listen, to speak out, because they don't agree. And they really see this as a bad foreign policy for the U.S. So I think there is a shift.
I think one of the tensions, though, in doing Palestine solidarity work as a Jew, and one of the potential pitfalls, is that that we not make it too much about us. And, you know, I think that's something we need to be aware of, that the first order of business is ending the oppression of Palestinians and liberating Palestinians and not liberating Judaism. I mean, that's important, too. But I think we need to be very, very, very clear that if we're in solidarity with Palestinians, it means we're accountable to them. And so I think the more successful we are, I think the more that's going to be something that we're going to need to address, that we don't want to hog the spotlight for these wonderful Jews who are standing in solidarity with Palestinians, as important as the work that we're doing is.
To be fair, the second half of my show is going to be with Craig McIver, who's talking about, you know, resigning from the UN. But I also do think it's important to show the world that the Jews who claim to speak for all of us and stand with Israel don't have a monopoly of what it means to be Jewish.
No question. No question.
And that, as you guys have articulated so well, it actually, I would argue, like the Jewish thing to do is to be in solidarity with Palestinians. It's not to be on the side of settler colonialism and ethno-nationalism.
Jay and I are part of Jewish Voice for Peace New York City, and I think Rabbi Brandt would really agree with this. We take our aim from Palestinian partners. Our Palestinian partners, we consult all the time. What should we do? We've gotten this idea that speaking out as Jews is helpful right now, that saying ceasefire now is the most urgent thing at this moment. But we feel like we're part of a movement that is guided by Palestinians. And that should always be the case as long as we're fighting for Palestinian liberation.
Yeah, that's key to any solidarity movement, is that kind of accountability.
And what is next for you guys?
More zip ties. There are some things in the works. There's a new initiative, ad hoc initiative you may have heard of, called Rabbis for Ceasefire. And there are many members of the JVP Rabbinical Council who are involved in it, but it's actually reached out beyond JVP. And we're actively trying to organize a larger group of rabbis who are not affiliated with JVP and may not be ready to be, but are ready to stand up publicly and say ceasefire now. And so we put out a statement and a viral video last week. There's going to be some more activities and actions in the future. So that's something I'm really excited about.
Roz and Jay, anything else you want to announce?
Can we reveal what's coming? Jay knows more than I do, but it's sort of on hope. We go day to day and week to week.
Yeah, and I would say in response as well to what the media has done and what narratives have changed, we have constantly been erased. And any change in narrative that Roz has described has been because of our organizing, the ways that we've intervened to challenge that. The day after our first march on October 7th to Senator Schumer's home, The Washington Post published an article that said Jews are united in solidarity with their support for Israel. The day after Roz and I were arrested, taken the next week outside of his home, the day that we were on a bus, there were multiple city bus fulls driving us to jail. Somebody announced on that bus, they did a mic check and announced, we have somebody on this bus who's 81 years old. She's older than the state of Israel. Roz is a living example that Judaism beyond Zionism is possible, that we can build a world beyond Zionism. But that next day, the New York Times on their cover published an article that said Jews across our differences are coming together to support Israel. So there was that constant erasure. And what we knew is that we would have to take historic, unprecedented action that has never happened before to create such a spectacle that could not be ignored. And that's what we did when we staged that massive sit-in in Congress, which was the largest mass arrest of rabbis in U.S. history. More than the 16 rabbis were arrested in St. Augustine, Florida, with Dr. King during the Civil Rights Movement. That's what we did when we took over Grand Central Station, the biggest train station in the world, completely shutting it down during rush hour traffic on Friday. That's how we got on the cover of the New York Times again. It isn't just that the reporters started to ask us questions. It's that we took action. 400 people were arrested that night. Thousands were packed inside. Thousands, I believe you even tried to get in and couldn't because there were so many thousands already inside that you joined the thousands overflowing outside into the streets of Midtown Manhattan. We know that the only way we can change narratives, the only way that we can build the international outcry necessary to stop the bombing is to keep organizing, to keep taking collective action on unprecedented scales. And so that's what we're going to continue to do. The night that I got out of jail with Roz after that picture that we saw outside of Schumer's, I got out of jail at 5 a.m. that morning and immediately got into organizing what we were doing next in D.C. The next day, I was supposed to be at the Yiddish Book Center for an exhibit that was opening that I have work in. And I've been planning to be at that exhibit opening for a long time. And the curator was invited me and excited for me to be there. I was in a car down to D.C. and that where I locked myself in a hotel room with the rest of the core organizers of that demonstration all week, because this is what we are doing in this moment. And we're going to continue to organize, to devote every waking second to continue to build the international outcry necessary to stop these bombs and to bring about justice for the people of Gaza, the Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, this has been so moving. We're going to show one more video of you guys at the Statue of Liberty.
Here in New York, about 500 members of Jewish Voice for Peace and their allies rallied at the Statue of Liberty Monday to demand a ceasefire in Gaza. Protesters wore black T-shirts reading, "Not in our name." In a statement, Jay Saper of Jewish Voice for Peace said, quote, "The famous words of our Jewish ancestor, Emma Lazarus, etched onto this very monument, compel us to take action supporting the Palestinians of Gaza yearning to breathe free," he said.
And that was really moving to be at the Statue of Liberty. So thanks for doing that.
You know, that shot of the Statue of Liberty, it's just a day old, but it's already iconic, you know, and these images speak so much louder than words. It's just very moving to be Jewish in this moment and see images like this.
Well, I have to say that it's Jay Saper and a small group of young people who have the most brilliant, creative, aesthetic, moral, and political and strategic minds I've ever encountered in my life. I feel honored to be led by Jay and the others in my JVP community. It is unbelievable to be at this stage of my life and to have this extraordinary group of young people. They are the leaders, they are the innovators, the creators, and I have hope because of them.
Well, this has been really great, and I'm so excited that you guys all came, and we're going to have to do more of these, and we'll do a panel that's, interfaith next. We'll do it with Jewish guests and non-Jewish guests, Palestinian guests and Jewish guests together. And we are going to bring on Craig McIver, who actually in his letter resigning from the UN cited the Grand Central protest. So that's a cool connection. So we're going to watch quickly just a little bit of my Rashida Tlaib video, because again, she's being criticized for daring to stand up for Palestinians. It's pretty disgusting. If you're a Democrat or a Republican, you say something totally vile about Palestinians, like comparing them to Nazis, which an actual congressman did, nothing happens to you. But if you argue that Palestinians are human beings, you get into trouble. So thank you so much, Rabbi and Roz and Jay. And come back.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks for having us.
Lovely. It was really great. Thank you.
I'm going to bring on Craig McIver, but Jay and Roz, do you want to say hi to Craig? Since I know you're fans, I'll bring you back on in case you do. Okay, welcome, Craig McIver. Thank you for joining.
Good to be here.
I just have to say, you are my hero. I spent many, many years doing things in the UN with transnational feminist groups. I am a student and a scholar of human rights, international human rights. And to have you speak out at this time when the UN is, I'm sorry, doing nothing, when the Security Council is a disaster. Thank you so much.
Now, Roz, right back at you. You are my hero. So is Jay. I wrote in my letter, and I've mentioned to everyone I've spoken to in the last several days how deeply, deeply moved. And I mean moved at a level that I haven't felt in a lot of years by the action at Grand Central Station just several days ago. And how I think that is an absolute game changer, and how it is providing a moral compass to people of every background. And helping them to make judgments about what's happening in the world, in particular what's happening in Gaza now, but even more broadly. And people keep asking me, you know, where's my hope? And I keep saying it's not in states, it's not in international institutions, it's in civil society, it's in movements, it's in people like you who are standing up for the cause of just basic human decency. So thank you very much. And thank you, Jay, as well. Really inspired stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. And also, please know that your words that you wrote in that letter reached everybody who took action to shut down Grand Central that evening and emboldened all of us to persist, because we got to see the impact of our action by you citing it. And it inspired everybody to continue to take action that we know we need to continue to do, to continue to build that international outcry. So thank you. We're honored to share this program with you, and honored for you speaking out in such courageous ways. Thank you.
No, thank you. Count on my solidarity for this and for everything else that comes along on the road. Really, really nice to be in touch with you folks.
Fantastic. Yeah. And thanks, Katie.
Thank you so much. And come back on.
Bring us all together. Okay,
great. Thank you so much. Okay, so Craig, thank you for joining. And again, Craig is a longtime international human rights lawyer who served as director of the New York Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. He resigned after publicly accusing the UN of failing to address what he calls a textbook case of genocide that's happening in Gaza. And his letter of resignation was leaked and became a bit of a viral sensation. So Craig, please tell us what made you resign and write that scathing letter.
Well, Katie, this conversation actually began in March after the series of atrocities that were happening on the West Bank, including the pogrom in Hawara and a number of Israeli military assaults on Palestinians in the West Bank. And, you know, at that moment, I sensed a real careful, trepidatious approach on the part of the UN. That was not responding with the level of concern and conviction that one would expect in the face of those kinds of atrocities. And I felt very much like this had been a trend that had been building over the course of many, many years, and it offended me. And so I was speaking out quite publicly as a UN human rights official, as I have on human rights situations in dozens of countries all around the world and on all continents. But there's something different when you speak out on Israeli violations. There is a well-oiled machine out there that will persecute you like crazy, make your life a living hell for a period of time, smear you and attack you, and bring pressure on the UN itself. And that's exactly what happened. There were a number of Israel lobby organizations that in addition to doing all sorts of online smears and so on against me, brought pressure on the UN to try in some way to punish me. Now, of course, it would be absurd for a UN human rights official to be punished for speaking out on human rights in any direct way. But there was an impact, and I felt it very strongly, and there was an effort to silence me from the organization itself, from the political corridors of the organization. And, you know, I had always said in my work in the UN for 32 years that I would stay on the inside working as long as I felt like I could do more good on the inside than the outside. I come from the human rights movement outside of the UN. And up until that point, I felt like, or let's say up until this year, I felt like I was doing more good. I was working in solidarity with human rights movements all around the world, and able, I think, to make a contribution without the kinds of constraints that I felt were growing in the organization. But this was something different. This was a real kind of a crackdown. And so I made a decision at that point that, you know, the time had come. And so I wrote to the High Commissioner for Human Rights in March already. Told him I was concerned about these trepidatious approaches, about a lack of conviction, about what I perceived as open fear of powerful states like the US, the UK, Israel, and of, you know, these lobby groups that had been set up to put pressure on the UN. And then I thought we were losing the way and that we needed to stand up and be more principled. Well, of course, since then, the situation only got worse in the West Bank, but then absolutely in Gaza, starting in with the October events. And that's when I sat down and decided to just clearly on the record in my capacity as the director of the Human Rights Office in New York, to put that letter to the senior most official responsible for human rights, the High Commissioner, where I laid out my concerns with regard to Palestine, with the UN's role for a very long time there, with the path that the UN was on that made it very ineffective in protecting Palestinian human rights, and to set out what I thought was a more principled course that was more consistent with the norms and standards of the organization. And interestingly, that letter was leaked first, as far as I can tell, to some Israel lobby groups, which used it to attack me. And then it went viral. And I have to say,
Mazel tov.
Right. There was actually a tidal wave of support that far overwhelmed any of the attacks, criticisms, death threats that I've been receiving in recent days. Smears, you know, the smears, you know, we're all well aware of this tactic by these pro-Israel groups that if you dare to criticize human rights violations committed by the Israelis, that they will smear you as an anti-Semite. So these groups actually put together a little research team, and they dug out everything I've ever said publicly about human rights since the 1980s. And they weren't able to find a single utterance of anything remotely anti-Semitic. So what they did was they consolidated all of the criticisms of Israeli violations I had made through the years and said, since he criticizes Israel, he's an anti-Semite, you know. And of course, we know the trick. We know it's not true, but it still hurts. And, you know, people who dedicate their life to fighting bigotry and for human rights and so on, when you hear those words, there's a little bit of a cut to it. And when you know anti-Semitism is a very real thing and there are Nazis marching in the streets and it's ascendant again and these far-right groups are persecuting and killing in the name of their insane ideologies, those words hurt. I don't think they convince many people anymore. And as I pointed out in my letter, I said that, you know, criticism of Israeli human rights violations is not anti-Semitic any more than criticism of Saudi violations is Islamophobic, criticism of violations from Burma is anti-Buddhist, or criticism of violations by India is anti-Hindu. And I think it just bears repeating over and over again because it is a smear tactic that's used. But all of these things taken together created this climate of fear in the UN, and I think knocked the UN off course, together with a distortion of the political agenda that began with the advent of the Oslo process 30 years ago. And so I made a number of comments about that as well and what I thought was a better course.
So there's a lot I want to ask you about. Let's start off with one of the central kind of claims of your letter and your resignation, which is that what is happening now in Gaza is a genocide. And as you've said, I know in other interviews, that's a very charged word. It's a very politicized word. But there is a real definition to it, and you are someone who's a human rights attorney. So why is it genocide? What's happening?
It is a very charged word. It's a very abused word. People claim it where it doesn't exist for political gain, and they deny it where it does exist for political reasons as well. But I look at it through the lens of the UN Genocide Convention and the law as it stands there. Genocide, and by the way, the convention is not just about punishment of genocide, it's about prevention of genocide. So it's not the kind of thing you can wait for the verdict of a court after mass murders have taken place and people have been purged from their lands. So I said we shouldn't be so reticent to address what looks very much like emerging genocide. And if you just look at the convention on genocide and you see the acts that are laid out that are genocidal acts, things like serious harm, including bodily harm, killings, which we've already seen, more than 10,000, that number is going to go up just in a matter of a few weeks. We've seen that number of killings. The imposition of conditions calculated to bring about a destruction of conditions of life calculated to bring out destruction. That one is non-controversial by now because of the siege on Gaza, the closure that's been in place for many, many years, which is specifically designed to affect the living conditions of the Palestinian people, limiting the amount of food and fuel and water and sanitation and medicine and construction materials and anything necessary for a dignified life, calculated to make sure that it's not a place where people are going to want to survive, making it hard for them to survive. All of those acts so clearly documented. But what I said was very unique about this was the degree to which Israeli authorities have been explicit in their expressions of intent, because the Genocide Convention requires a specific intent to destroy in whole or in part a particular group as such, a group defined in this case as Palestinians in Gaza and Palestinians more broadly. Normally, you've got to dig through all sorts of dark, sealed, secret records to identify intent in genocide. Here, you had the president, prime minister, senior cabinet officials, senior military officials, and others, think tanks associated with and working with the government, clearly, publicly, and on the record stating their genocidal intent. Dehumanizing Palestinians, denying there's a difference between civilians and combatants, calling for wholesale wiping out, calling for a new Nakba, the prime minister invoking a biblical verse that refers to wiping out everybody, men, women, children, suckling babies, livestock, the whole,
so insane.
The whole population, sparing them not, according to that verse. And this is, I mean, every day there are more and more of these. This is the sound of impunity, because people don't openly declare these things in public unless they're absolutely certain they're not going to be held accountable. So they have to be held accountable. And in this case, such an extraordinary case of very clearly stated intent on the public record, I said, you have a prima facie case of genocide. Not genocide used in a metaphorical way, but a textbook, convention-defined case of genocide. And then when you add to that the context of the actions we're seeing now, which is that this is just the latest phase in a series of ethnic purges that began in 1948 with the Nakba, and then continued from 1948 and 1967 inside portions of Israel where there were other ethnic cleansings taking place. After 1967, continuing unabated in the West Bank to the point where the West Bank, you know, you've seen pictures of the map. There's very little left of Palestinian life in the West Bank. It's all settled. And now you see the final portion of that move, which is the ethnic cleansing in Gaza, starting with the north of Gaza and working their way systematically and horrifically southward toward the gate with Rafah, with Egypt, clearly with the intention of ultimately making living conditions impossible for those who survive in the hopes that they will then go and die in the Sinai Desert somewhere. Problem then solved, you see. So it is a very clear case. And one of the other things I found most disturbing about it was the degree of complicity by powerful Western governments, including the U.S. government, in these actions, because, you know, international humanitarian. So the Genocide Convention requires action on the part of states to stop this, to prevent it and to stop it. And they're not acting to do that, to the contrary. And the Geneva Conventions require not just that states respect the Geneva Conventions, but they're also obliged to ensure respect for those conventions. In other words, to use whatever power or influence they have over Israel to stop these atrocities from taking place. That's not what the U.S. has been doing. To the contrary, they've not only been breaching that, they've been taking it to the next level of complicity by funding, arming, providing diplomatic cover, providing intelligence support, providing the veto in the Security Council in order to actively engage in supporting the Israeli assault on the people in Gaza. So it's very extraordinary. It would require a very principled and courageous position on the part of the UN, particularly the political leadership of the UN, which we have not seen. And at a moment like this, I mean, this is a moment in history that we are going to, those of us who get to survive, are going to remember for many decades in the future. At a moment like this, a careful, trepidatious, lackluster response is a breach of all of the norms upon which the organization was founded. And so I said so. And I included that genocide analysis in the letter as well.
So let's say we had a courageous UN, what would they be doing?
Well, you know, if you, I, because, you know, I've worked on human rights in, as I said, dozens of countries on in all regions of the world. There's a kind of a standard package here when you have these kinds of situations that are always applied that include things like, first of all, a law-based response based on human rights law, humanitarian law, the charter, not deferring to some amorphous political formula or some kind of exceptionality where, yes, of course, the ideally, but that doesn't apply here, which is the way that Israel's been dealt with for many, many years by the UN, perhaps forever. But really getting back to the law, the requirements of human rights law, humanitarian law, international criminal law, international refugee law, and the charter itself. In all other situations, we demand equality. We would be demanding here equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews. That's not happening. It's always, well, let's talk about two states and some Bantustans in the West Bank, and let's not do anything to insist that Israel has to conform to international human rights standards as well. Let them have their ethno-nationalist state. Let them continue their settler colonial project.
Which they, of course, frame as Israel's right to exist.
Right.
And the right to have a Jewish state. I mean, they frame it, right? Instead of framing it as a settler colonial project, they frame it disingenuously as a project of Jewish safety.
Yeah. Yeah. But anywhere else, you know, there would be a very clear proposition, and there would be a demand for a transitional justice process. There'd be a demand for an international tribunal. There'd be a demand for the right to return of those who have been purged from the land and for compensation for them. There would be a demand for the end of apartheid. There is an apartheid system. It's not even controversial in the international human rights community because it is a position that's been taken by every international human rights organization, is, you know, mainstream Israeli human rights organizations, Palestinian, UN, independent UN human rights mechanisms. That would be the focus of attention as well. But none of that is being, there would be a move to provide protection for civilians, including a protection force in the country, as we've provided in so many other countries around the world. So none of that applies because of this kind of idea of exceptionalism that is opposed. And what has happened instead is that, especially since Oslo, you've had this game which is played in public where people will give, say, some mantras like two-state solution, UN quartet, Oslo, you know, all of these kinds of, you know, the peace process, all of these kinds of mantras that nobody believes really exist in real life. That it's not possible to have a two-state solution anyway because there's nothing left for a sustainable Palestinian state. And Israel is not, under this government or any subsequent government, going to give up enough land for a sustainable Palestinian state, one. Two is, even if you had a two-state solution, it wouldn't address the human rights questions, the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people, because they would be relegated forever, those who remain inside the Green Line, to being second-class citizens who are not equal, who can't have nationality, who can't have the same economic, social, civil, political, and cultural rights of other ethnic groups in the country. And so that doesn't resolve it. But when you don't want to address the real issues at hand, you'd simply say, we're going to have a two-state solution someday. But what has happened with behind the curtain of Oslo and the two-state solution and the quartet and all of this, what's happened behind that curtain is that for this past 30 plus years, the situation has gotten worse and worse and worse. It has just been a smokescreen behind which you've had an exacerbation of the critical human rights situation of the Palestinian people, a continuation of settler colonialism, an expansion of illegal settlement activity. And that brings us to where we are today. And if the UN and the international community and some states in the West don't make a pivot toward human rights and away from this game that they've been playing for the past 30 plus years, we're entering into a very, very dark chapter in the history of the world. So I just think all we have to do is play by the rules here as we would insist in other places. And that's the answer. You know, for me, you know, a single democratic secular state with equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews, to which the Israeli lobby accuses me of calling for the destruction of Israel. And I say, I'm not calling for the destruction of Israel. I'm calling for the destruction of apartheid. I'm calling for equality. I'm calling for the salvation of Israel and Palestine, you know, in the process, because this is not, you know, if the argument is the safety of Israelis, this is not a path toward the safety of Israelis. You know, this is a deeply racist, extremely violent path on which that country has committed itself. And there is another way. It's called equality. But, you know, many in positions of authority, including in the UN, don't dare to say so.
So Israel is kind of presenting what they're doing as within the rules of law. They constantly say, you know, they have their talking points. So Hamas uses human shields, which is funny because if they were using human shields, that would imply that it would stop them from doing what they're doing. In order to be an effective shield, Israel would have to not do what they're doing, but they're not. So they say that. Then they say, you know, they had to kill this person, right? There was a Hamas person, so they have to kill countless civilians. Can you talk about all the ways they do violate human rights law? I know it's probably you'd be here like for, you know, a 24-hour marathon. You don't have that time, but just some of them, like proportionality, distinction, and also give people a sense of what a country could do, right? Let's say Israel wanted to go after Hamas. And I mean, this is not going to be solved militarily, but I'm just asking from like one discrete question of how does a country that fight, that wages war, that does not violate international law, what would that look like?
So those are all excellent questions. You know, the thing on human shields, this is a standard tagline that's used when there are mass civilian casualties. Israel has done this in all of its previous attacks in the past. The use of human shields doesn't mean that there are civilians around. It means that you intentionally take civilians and you, it's, by the way, we've seen the Israelis do in the occupied territories. And, you know, you sort of parade them in front of you as a human shield. You put them on the jeep, you put them in a particular location and so on. I mean, Hamas doesn't do that. Hamas is located in one of the most densely populated civilian territories in the world, not because they decided to locate themselves in the midst of civilians. They're Gazans. Many of them have never been outside the cage in their entire life. They were born into it. So, and that's not human shields being in those areas. And you know, by the way, Israel has military command centers and in densely populated civilian areas. So that doesn't mean human shields. Secondly, you know, even if you say that there is a combatant in the midst of those civilians and you're going after the combatant, that is not a justification under international humanitarian law. As you mentioned, there are principles that have to be respected. Proportionality is one of them. Principle of distinction between combatants and non-combatants and their facilities is another one. The principle of precaution is another one. The law requires that you look for lawful means that will spare civilians. You don't, otherwise, you can just do what this insane minister in Israel asked for yesterday or the day before and just drop a nuclear weapon on Gaza, right? Because, oh, there's combatants everywhere, so we'll just nuke the whole place. I mean, this is not a lawful justification. This is a genocidal approach. So international law does not provide that out for them. to answer your bigger question, what would you do to end attacks by Hamas? You could end the occupation because it is an armed resistance group which is fighting against the occupation. Now, if you think that somebody in Hamas, and clearly in this case they have committed war crimes, you can hold them accountable under the rule of law. So, you know, I remember very well after September 11th, our office issued an appeal to the United States to treat this as a crime against humanity and to go after the perpetrators under the rule of law, to bring them to accountability, bring them to trial, and show the moral high ground to those who would use violence versus those who would use the rule of law and international standards. Of course, the U.S. chose another course. They went on a global temper tantrum that ended up in the deaths of millions of civilians around the world. So that is, I mean, that is a lesson that is to be learned. If Israel wanted to see accountability for Hamas perpetrators or those who commanded them, who actually committed war crimes on October the 7th, they would have a lot of international solidarity for doing so. There could be a process, there could be indictments, there could be investigations, but it is very clear to me this is not about Hamas. It's about clearing, using the pretext of the horrific, you know, attacks on the 7th as a pretext for the ethnic cleansing and total destruction of Gaza, because tactically you can't imagine that that's what they're really trying to do. You know, when you say there's one Hamas commander and you know you're in a densely populated refugee camp like Jabalia, and you drop massive ordnance on top of it, creating a huge crater, and killing so many people, nobody believes that that was an attempt just to kill a particular commander. If you know, the metaphors are out there everywhere. You know, you have some terrorist goes into a school and has a bunch of school children, you know, and so the police say, okay, we'll drop a bomb and kill everybody in the building. We got the terrorists. You also killed all the kids, you know. So clearly that is not the case. Neither, it's clear, is the main intention to free the hostages, the prisoners that have been taken by Hamas, because this is not what you would do if you were worried about the safety of the hostages. Who knows how many of them have been killed already under Israeli bombs, right? And how many more will be killed as well? So it's clear that that's really not what that is, about.
Yeah, that's kind of stunning, by the way, that point that you just brought up, because it's clear Israel does not care about Palestinian life, but they also don't care about Israeli life. They care about vengeance. And, you know, the New York Times, I think, talked about the aura of potency or something that they're seeking to reestablish.
Yeah.
That they would just be bombing potentially, and we'll see when some of the fog of war clears, but who knows, as you said, how many of their own Israeli hostages they've killed themselves through bombing.
Unquestionably. I mean, they're with the Gazans, you know, they're in the same places. And so, and by the way, they're in the hospitals getting treatment when hospitals are being bombed. They're, you know, all of this. So this is not about the hostages. And I don't even think it's vengeance. I think that it is a much more calculated, it's not a temper tantrum. It is a pretext for the clearing of Gaza. In the public, they've been trying to stir up as much hunger for vengeance as possible so that the government can have the space that it needs to carry out these kinds of atrocities. But I think it is a very considered and intentional series of actions that are going to continue as well. So, but what I have said before is any Hamas fighters or, you know, armed groups living under occupation have a right to resist as a matter of international law against military targets. They don't have a right to attack civilians, right? So any Hamas fighters who committed war crimes against civilians or the commanders who ordered them should be held accountable under the rule of law. When I'm interviewed in Western media, everybody wants to hear that, but they don't want to talk about holding Israel accountable for its atrocities before October the 7th, including, you know, a peak of them throughout this year that led to these kinds of reactions. They don't want to talk about the atrocities that have been happening for 75 years and a lack of accountability there. And they don't want to talk about accountability for Israeli war crimes since October the 7th, as if this is, you know, you solve this problem by seeking accountability for Hamas crimes. And then you ignore year after year, decade after decade, and again now, massive atrocities being perpetrated by the Israelis. If you believe in the rule of law, the answer is, you know, fight whatever war you want to fight, but there are rules. You know, international humanitarian law, international human rights law, international criminal law imposes rules, and those have to be respected by everybody, and they are not being respected by Israel. So I'm all for accountability, but it's got to be accountability for all perpetrators and redress for all victims.
So just for argument's sake, I want to convince, let's say I'm talking to people who are saying Israel has no other choice. Like, you and I obviously agree that ending the occupation is necessary. But let's say you're just a normie who doesn't think that the occupation should be ended or can be ended. What is a way to wage that war, just to show people all the steps that they're not taking for safety? Like, what is a way that they could prosecute the war that doesn't commit all these war crimes? Does that make sense, my question?
I mean, it's a difficult question to answer because the law, the war, so, you know, the laws of war, they have two pieces, right? Part of it is legal justification for going to war in the first place. And the other is legality of action once you're at war, the things that you do not violate, right? So, like, you know, you're not committing aggression. And then while you're fighting the war after the aggression, you're not violating individual rights of people and so on. The problem is that Israel is standing on a very shaky moral ground when it wages war against occupied territories where it is the occupying power. Under international humanitarian law, their principal duty is to protect the people in the occupied territory. So as long as that occupation continues to actually wage war, you can have police actions for public well-being and so on, but actually wage war in this way, a massive war like that, they have a very difficult justification under international law for doing so. But if they wanted to deal with the issue of armed attacks in the country, and I'll go back to my original comment, you know, people living under a brutal foreign occupation will always and forever resist. If they kill every Hamas commander and combatant, they've just created thousands more with their current actions. You know, if you were born into a cage, persecuted, spat upon, periodically bombed, denied hope, opportunity, movement, denied civil rights, political rights, economic and social rights, denied adequate food and shelter and housing and water and sanitation, hated and despised and attacked your entire life, and your parents as well, and your grandparents as well, you're going to resist. I would resist, you would resist, anybody would resist. It's not something that that people, and when you see that it's based upon who you are, your ethnicity, it cuts even more deeply, and people are going to resist.
And also when you're killed, nonviolently resisting, that also doesn't help.
Well, I mean, look at what the Palestinians have done. They have tried to resist through nonviolent means like boycotts and divestments and so on. And then they're called anti-Semites. They have tried to use courts and tribunals to bring their case under the rule of law. And then they're told that they're jeopardizing peace. They tried to have Gandhi and Martin Luther King like marches, like the March of Return. And they're cut down, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, by Israeli snipers who target people in wheelchairs and who target children, who target medics and who target the press and who target peaceful demonstrators and so on. And then if you try to fight back with armed struggle, you're a terrorist. So what the other side wants you to do is just to die or to go away. You don't have to die, but either you have to die or you have to go away. I mean, this is the whole genocidal mentality of the thing, the whole ethnic cleansing mentality of the thing. So it will not ever end. If you really want violence to end, you have to end the injustice. You have to end the occupation. You have to sit down and you have to be. It never happened. I mean, the entire Oslo process was a smokescreen. I say that as somebody who worked in the context of Oslo as a human rights advisor for the UN and the occupied territories under one of the architects of Oslo, Terje Larsen, who was one of the original architects and so on. And Oslo in the early years, it brought in some development aid and it brought in some humanitarian assistance and some daily space for the Palestinians to live with a little dignity after the daily abuses to which they've been subjected. But behind that wall of Oslo, what was happening was there was no intention of exchanging land for peace, as the slogan was. It was all a way of disarming the international community to allow the further expansion of Israeli settler colonialism into the West Bank and Jerusalem, to the point now where, as I said, there's nothing left. And then this is the last piece that they want to deal with. I said in my letter, we're entering, you know, sort of the final phase of this project. And if the international community doesn't step up now, you know, the Palestinians will be forced to go the way of the Native Americans and the successful genocide that was perpetrated against them. And that's a too tough of a pill, I think, to swallow for most decent people around the world, which is why we see so many people rising up against it. So you know, you could negotiate, you could follow international law, you could show goodwill by holding perpetrators of war crimes accountable. You could have police actions where you think there are perpetrators, although it's a little unbalanced because how are the Palestinians going to arrest Israeli war criminals, you know? But what you shouldn't be doing is continued expansion and massacres and you know, frankly, trying to hold on to a paradigm that will never, ever, ever bring peace or security to anybody, ever. And you know, people need to know, I think the reason for this kind of open genocidal strategy is because they too have realized what I'm saying now, which is that it's impossible. You know, you're not going to lull the Palestinians into sleep. You just march silently to their death or their disappearance. And so, you know, they understand this far-right government and this deeply racist core in the society that the only hope they have is ethnic cleansing and genocide. And it's not going to work either because they're not going to succeed in that way either. So I don't have any advice for them except the advice that I have for every other country, which is international human rights, international law. I said before, you know, 1948, which was the year of the Nakba and the first genocidal purge, was the same year that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted. And it was the same year that apartheid was adopted in South Africa. And the international community stayed very focused on insisting on human rights and international law in apartheid South Africa until apartheid fell. They didn't do the same thing for Palestine. They abandoned that paradigm when Oslo started. And this is what it has led to. So let's get back to international law. Let's get back to international human rights. Let's declare for Israel and Palestine what we declare for every other situation in the world, which is equality.
What is Israel's goal right now with Gaza? The ethnic cleansing you mentioned, is it for geopolitical reasons? People have been talking about gas, access to gas. What do you think the real motives are? Or is it a combination?
I mean, I have no doubt that they will have already mapped out whatever natural resource possibilities are available off the shore of Gaza and so on. But I don't think that's the principal purpose. I think this has been... So here's, I mean, you can't talk about any of this without talking about settler colonialism and what, you know, what's behind these sorts of movements. I mean, this is a movement, a settler colonial movement that goes back almost 100 years. And the intention is a very simple one, which is to wrest the land from the indigenous people and put it in the hands of a privileged religio-ethnic group in place of those people because of a kind of supremacist ideology. I mean, when you talk about equality for Christians, Muslims, and Jews, you're attacked very viciously by adherents of this particular political ideology because that's offensive to them. Right? That's when they say you want to destroy Israel, because their idea of Israel is this you know, ethno-nationalist kind of an entity. So I think the principal motive is just to wrest from the Palestinians the last pieces of land of historic Palestine, including what is in Gaza. And we see that it's been much more incremental in the West Bank. But if you look at the map, you see there's very little left there either. And I think that's the principal driving force here. I think there are other factors as well. You know, Netanyahu maybe would have been in jail by now on corruption charges. And he knows that in that country, as in many countries, the best way to build public support and to divert attention away from your own crimes is to start a war and rally everyone behind you, you know. So, you know, I think that's a piece of it as well. But in the end, it all comes back to just this ethno-nationalist settler colonial project and finishing what was started in 1948. And that's why I think it's so important not to sort of play these calendar games where you just pick out a date when something bad happens and you say the world began on that date. You have to look at these successive waves of ethnic cleansing that have defined this project since before 1948, but certainly since 1948. And that's what I think that's what's happening in Gaza. And if in the process they can get natural gas, if in the process Netanyahu can get a stronger political constituency, if in the process they can build a security zone, if in the process, all of that is gravy, but it's not the central point.
You spent time in Gaza, living in Gaza.
I did.
What can you tell people about that experience?
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.